around the city. Tune in into the next installment of Ear to the Streets of Portland with music and conversations featuring Michael Hicks of the Black Rose Books and the creator of the upcoming Portland Natural Hair Expo in May. Next installment of Ear to the Streets of Portland is Thursday, April 17th, starting at 7 o'clock p.m. right here on your community radio station, KABU 90.7 FM Portland, or online at www.kabu.fm.
People ask me everywhere, is that really all your hair?
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang. Show is Fight the Empire. Before we get into the show, I'd like to say a little bit about Mike Rupert. You know, we're really going to miss the guy. He's been a guest on this show several times in a few years back. He's always been a friend of KABU, and a few years back, he gave a talk at the Unitarian Church. It was a benefit for KABU. He's a troubled guy, but he did a lot. He accomplished a lot of things, and I'm not going to say too much. You can go on the internet. He had an internet radio show called The Lifeboat Hour on Sunday evenings, and last Sunday he did his show. His guest was Carolyn Baker, who is a writer and psychologist, an old friend of his, and they did this show, and then he, after the show, he went home and he shot himself. That's all I'm going to say. I mean, you can go on. Carolyn Baker will be doing the show next Sunday at 6 p.m., so I'm sure she will talk about Mike. She knew him a lot better than I did. And but all I can say is we're really going to miss him. This year is the 20th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide, so the mainstream media has been giving us a lot of stories about it. It's a little bit like coming into the middle of a movie and trying to figure out what's going on, because all the media stories start sort of with 1994 when it happened, but the history really goes back much further than that. There are two, as we all know, there are two main tribes in Rwanda and Burundi. There are the Hutu, who are about 84% of the population, and the Tutsi, who are about 15% of the population. The Hutu, according to one account, they are farmers generally, and they are originated from West Africa, then they came into the what they call the Great Lakes area of Africa, where the Tutsi were cattle herders who came down from the north. And this is kind of important because in that part of the continent, cattle were wealth. So if you had a herd of cattle, you were automatically pretty wealthy. Well, in the old days, the king of Rwanda, Urundi. It was a sort of combined nation. And it was ruled by a Tutsi king, and it had a feudal society where all the levels of the hierarchy were all occupied by Tutsis. And the Hutu peasants were kind of down there at the bottom. A lot of people say that there was sort of not so much an ethnic distinction between the two. They supposedly talked the same language and everything. It was a class distinction. Or actually, if you were a Hutu and you were able to accumulate a few cattle, you could sort of become an honorary Tutsi. Well, this kingdom of Rwanda, it went right into the colonial period. In 1890, the Brussels Conference turned over Rwanda and Burundi to Germany. And the Germans, they believed that the Tutsis really kind of a superior race. They were taller, had different facial features. They were sort of, quote, more European. And so the Germans helped the Tutsis put down a Hutu rebellion in 1911, and they ruled via the Tutsis. Then after World War I, which we might remember was sort of an imperial war, of all the nations in Europe, about 8 or 9 of them were all empires, and they all were fighting each other. And after World War I, Germany lost, of course, and so their empire was divided up among the victors. And Belgium got what was called Rwanda-Urundi, and they already had the neighboring Congo, which they had thoroughly destroyed. Congo was first a personal property of King Leopold, but his atrocities are so bad that he turned it over to the Belgian government. So Belgium got Rwanda-Urundi, and they continued the Tutsi power structure. They originated, did a lot of improvements in agriculture. They introduced the coffee crop, and to pick the coffee required forced labor. So that's what the Belgians did. They had forced labor, maybe not as cruel as the neighboring Congo, where they had rubber plantations, where if you didn't pick enough rubber, you might have your hands amputated. That's what the Belgians did, folks, civilized Belgium. And so... But the Belgians, they had coffee pickers among the Hutu, and they had forced labor. They called it a corvée, very feudal kind of thing. At that time, they also, eugenics was a big deal, and they had so-called European scientists came to Rwanda and to measure skulls. They'd measure the skulls of the Hutus and the Tutsis. And through their measurements, they perpetuated this idea that somehow the Tutsis were a more, they were a superior race, which, as we said, originated with the Germans when they ran the country. And the Tutsis are sort of somehow whiter. And the Belgian rulers, they introduced racial ID cards. Well, with all this, the Tutsis began to believe it. They really began to believe that they were sort of the better people and more suited to running the government. You have to keep in mind that the Hutu were about 84-85% of the population, and they were ruled by the Tutsis, who were only 15%. And you think, how does that happen, you know? Well, then came independence. Now, back in the 50s, you had this idea of Pan-Africanism, and that arrived in the 1950s with Julius Nyerere of Tanzania and Patrice Lumumba in neighboring Congo. Well, we know what happened to Lumumba. He tried to hold Congo together. He was an elected leader who was assassinated by the Belgians through their... mercenaries there from Katanga in eastern Congo. So Pan-Africanism came to Rwanda, and a man named Gregoire Kayibanda led what they call the Hutu emancipation. That these people who were really downtrodden for centuries at the low end of the hierarchy, they were emancipating themselves, and the Tutsis, of course, didn't like that. So they organized their own counter-movement. Tutsis actually tried to assassinate Kayibanda. And there were other rumors of assassinations, and that started what is known as the Wind of Destruction, in which the Hutus struck back and went to war against the Tutsis. And at that time, this country split into two. One was Rwanda and one was Burundi. They're side by side, both small countries, and they have the same population breakdown of Hutu majority and a Tutsi minority. And the Tutsi monarchy was finally voted out of power. And so Tutsi, you know, they exiles, they formed guerrilla armies and struck back from neighboring countries, mainly Uganda. Then in 1973, a military man named Juvenal Habyarimana overthrew Kayibanda, and he instituted kind of one-party military rule. He was a Hutu, but over the years, he began moving towards multi-party rule. Neighboring Burundi was under Tutsi army rule until 1993. And during that time, there was a genocide, which we don't hear about very much, but there was a genocide against the Hutus in 1972. 200,000 Hutus were killed by the Tutsi army in Burundi. Well, the Tutsi exiles, they kind of joined up with Uganda. They became actually part of the Uganda military, and they organized the Rwanda Patriotic Front, which is led by a man named Paul Kagame, who was actually trained in the United States. He'd been a student at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. Well, the Rwanda Patriotic Front, the RPF, they invaded Rwanda in 1990. So here we are. We have, you know, the Hutus achieve power, and they, but the exiled Tutsis form their army, and they're invading. They want to take that. They want to take that power back. Well, the fighting went on for several years, and then there was a ceasefire in 1993. During that time, the Burundi Tutsis assassinated a Hutu-elected president. Remember now that the Burundi was ruled by a Tutsi army, but then they elected a Hutu president, and the Burundi Tutsis assassinated him. Well, there were peace talks going on. A ceasefire was arrived at in 1993, and there were ceasefire talks in neighboring Tanzania, and they reached an agreement. And then in 1994, a plane carrying the presidents of Burundi and Rwanda was shot down. Now, Habyarimana was a president of Rwanda, and the president of Burundi was also on that plane. It was shot down, and both of them were killed. And we have a lot of evidence that three Tutsi fighters later said that they helped shoot down the plane. A former ally of Paul Kagame says that Kagame boasted of ordering the strike. So here we have, after this war and invasion, and finally a ceasefire is reached, but the two presidents who reached that ceasefire were killed when their plane was shot down. And that is where the mainstream media enters the movie. That's the part of the movie, this is where we enter. Because in response, the Tutsi military began striking out, and they wound up killing, it's estimated, the best estimate is about 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus. And then later on, the Rwanda Patriotic Front was able to conquer Rwanda. Kagame is their president right now. He is still, his luster is wearing off. People are realizing that he does not run a democracy. There are sort of rigged elections. His opponents are thrown in jail, and his opponents abroad are also assassinated. Recently, there was some Rwanda military man who was assassinated in South Africa, I believe. And also, with Kagame in power, the wars in Rwanda and Burundi has spread to the Eastern Congo. Now, let's remember that Eastern Congo is the area that tried to secede when Patrice Lumumba was president of the Congo. And that rebellion was kind of fostered by Belgian mining interests. Of course, Lumumba was assassinated by the Belgians. And so you have the same forces in Eastern Congo ripping off all these minerals in Eastern Congo. One of the most important ones is called coltan. Without coltan, we wouldn't have all our little special smartphones and computers and all that. That's where coltan comes from. And in the Congo Wars, more than 5 million people have been killed. We're getting up to 6 million killed in the Congo Wars since they began. And what's happening is that Rwanda and Uganda, although they fight between them, they have been able to grab coltan and these other minerals and sell them on the market. And we might ask, where do they go? Well, a lot of them go to, I think mainly, as far as I can tell, they go to Europe, the United States, and China, sort of the main industrial powers in the world. So that is sort of that's what we should think about, you know, as we hear about the genocide and the massacres in Rwanda, that there is a background to this. We have been sort of led to believe that the Tutsi are the sort of the good guys and the Hutu are the bad guys, but it's not as simple as that. We also hear that there's really not much difference between the Hutu and the Tutsis, that they have intermarried a lot since way back when. They speak the language. It's kind of hard to tell them apart, and that it's become more a matter of class. Like we did mention earlier that a Tutsi who was able to get a little herd of cattle could become an honorary Tutsi. Well, if you look at the definition of genocide, it does not include classes. In other words, genocide includes a violence directed against racial, religious, or ethnic groups. It does not include, say, violence directed against the poor or violence directed against the rich. So if that is the case, if that is how you want to define genocide, and if you want to look at the Hutu and Tutsi as separate classes, then it's not really a genocide. Strictly speaking, it's still horrible. It's still a lot of people killed, but it's more a class war than anything else. So there we are. That sort of brings us to Rwanda and Burundi as they exist today. I'd like to get a little bit onto what's going on in Ukraine. That stays in the news. There is a conference in Geneva right now where Ukraine and the West, the U.S. and NATO, are supposedly confronting Mr. Putin. And hard to say where to begin on this. We've had a grudge against Putin ever since he took over back after the Soviet Union collapsed. Boris Yeltsin was the ruler there, and basically he gave away the store. That's when all these oligarchs began appearing. The oligarchs were people who were in Russia, who were able to gain control of state property and sell them in the West or whatever, and they all became billionaires. I don't know how many oligarchs there are. There's Russian oligarchs, there's Ukrainian oligarchs, there's some who live in Britain. That's how they got their start. Well, Boris Yeltsin died of being a drunk, and he selected Vladimir Putin to succeed him. Well, Putin put an end to the uh, giving away the store. And that is why Putin, he may be an autocrat, he may not be a nice guy, but a lot of Russians really admire him because he stood up to the West. He stopped this bleeding of Russia. Well, our Secretary of State, John Kerry, talks a lot about territorial integrity regarding Ukraine. There's a if you can get on the internet and Google, type in 1,000 years of your European border changes. I don't know exactly what the URL is on that, but 1,000 years of European border changes, and you will get this very interesting little video. It has a map of Europe, including Russia, including part of the Ottoman Empire. And so here's this map with all these different countries. And what it does, it compresses 1,000 years of border changes into about, a couple minutes. And so these nations, you just see all these different nations kind of grow and vanish and diminish and split apart and just kind of, it's ever-changing mosaic. And that is how borders are created. And actually, if you look at this video, there is no Ukraine at all until near the end. That's when Ukraine became a so-called nation. Before that, there were Ukrainian people, but they were always ruled by foreign conquerors. And so Ukraine didn't become a kind of a separate entity until actually after the Russian Revolution in 1922, the Bolshevik government kind of delineated the borders of Ukraine as pretty much as they are now. And so this is how borders are created. But John Kerry will talk a lot about Ukraine's territorial integrity. In other words, if you look up the definition of territorial integrity, it means that a border cannot be changed by an outside power. In other words, conquering is out. That is illegal. Doesn't say anything about changing borders by the people who live within those borders. It's a big distinction here. So when you talk about territorial integrity in Ukraine, you might ask, what kind of integrity does Ukraine have at present? It is composed of two languages, two religions. You have the Ukrainians in one area and the Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the other. You also had the Crimea, which was able to secede and kind of join up with Russia. So you have this country that is sharply divided. Although there's intermingling and stuff, but it's pretty much divided. You can see it by the election results. And there is nothing sacred about these borders. They were created through conquest and the and decision of the Bolsheviks back in 1922. And so there's nothing sacred about these borders. I would think the concept of self-determination and a free people trumps it every time. If you have a free people who can decide on their own nation state, then they can change those borders because they are not doing it from outside. They are doing it from inside. And so the West, they came right up to the borders of Russia. Now, it's just amazing the hypocrisy going on here. All the things that the West is accusing the Russians of doing, the West has already done itself. It's, if it wasn't, if people weren't getting killed, and it would be sort of laughable. So there's this Geneva conference going on right now. Meanwhile, the regular Ukrainian troops are going into eastern Ukraine. One of the Ukraine oligarchs was appointed by the Kiev government to rule over Donetsk, one of the main cities in eastern Ukraine, the Russian-speaking part. Well, the Ukraine troops are in there, but apparently they're switching sides. There's a very embarrassing incident just the other day where some tanks came in and then they got stalled, and they were stalled not by Russian troops or anything, but by Ukrainian pro-Russian civilians, and so the Ukrainian troops got out of their tanks and left, and the civilians put Russian flags on these tanks and drove off with them. Also, the security head of the Kiev government, a man named Andriy Poruby, who is a right-winger, extreme right-winger, is the security honcho in Kiev. And apparently the Ukraine army is not reliable, so he has been taking these right-wing militias, the right sectors, they're neo-Nazis basically, and forming them into a National Guard, a kind of a stormtrooper group, and apparently he is sending them into eastern Ukraine. And if that is true, it can be very ominous and really could lead to war. There's also an interesting article by a man named Boris Kagarlitsky, who is a Russian social democrat who's been around for quite a while. And he looks at what's going on in Ukraine as a kind of a real people's movement that has gotten beyond the control of the West and is getting beyond the control of Russia, and that it is leading to a kind of a real people's movement. And if that is true, I think that would be really kind of welcome. But we will have to see. Right now, you have the West is trying to get Putin to back down. And as far as I can tell, he is holding out for pretty reasonable grounds, that he wants to have that the Russian-speaking Ukrainians would like to have a plebiscite. They don't necessarily want to join Russia, but they do want to have more autonomy. They want their language back. One of the first things the Kiev government did was to abolish Russian as a second official language, but they backed down on that, and I guess the eastern Ukrainians want that to be permanent. They want to have their language. They want to have more power. They want to be able to rule themselves rather than have sort of these Kiev-appointed oligarchs ruling over them. So that is what they are holding out for. And when you think about it, the West has very, very little to offer. Right now, the West is going to impose its austerity on the Ukrainians. In other words, the Ukrainians are going to go through what Greece and Spain and Italy are going through right now. And we will see where that leads, whether the West can make it stick at all. If they do, if the West offers Ukraine a special deal as far as austerity goes, you might expect people in Spain and Italy and Greece to demand the same for themselves. So there we are. This Ukraine thing is not going to go away, and we will keep our eye on it. And actually, what you just heard here and previously on Press Watch, you will not get this on the mainstream media. The thing has just amazed me over the last year or so is how one-sided the mainstream media has been on Ukraine, and I am definitely including NPR. Their reporting has been terrible. Sometimes they're pretty good on other issues, but on this one, they have fallen down totally. So stay tuned to KBOO for the real news you're not supposed to know.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is just a minute before 10 o'clock, and in an hour, it'll be a special hour-long Between the Covers at 11 with guest local writer Tom Spanbauer, the critically acclaimed author and founder of Dangerous Writing. But first, it's a special hour-long Flashpoint since Eric Cascadia is off today. Today they feature these stories, brute force and the use of torture in the U.S. public school system. Also, tracking white supremacists in the wake of the recent killings in Kansas City. And the weekly report from the Electronic Intifada, hosted by Nora Barrows Friedman. That is all coming up on Flashpoints. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Our jails and prisons have become overcrowded with people suffering from mental illness. Many people incarcerated are also addicted to drugs and alcohol. What treatment is being provided? Tune in to Prison Pipeline April 14th to hear Doyle Smith of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon talk about the need for treatment programs in our jails and prisons. That's Prison Pipeline April 14th at 6:30 p.m.
Brute force and the use of torture in the U.S. public school system. Also tracking white supremacists in the wake of the recent killings in Kansas City. And we'll feature our weekly broadcast from the Electronic Intifada, hosted by Nora Barrows Friedman. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we turn our attention to the recent shooting in Kansas City, which reflected really an ongoing battle against white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and you could call them Nazis. They would be proud to take that label on. They are in and out of the military, as this shooter was. And we want to focus on what happened in